The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/greenimpact.
Introducing Batiste Sweat-Activated and Touch-Activated Dry Shampoo. With breakthrough technology that absorbs oil and releases bursts of fragrance whenever you sweat or touch your hair for up to 24 hours, it's the ultimate hair care for girls on the go. Try the newest dry shampoo that's activated by you. Batiste, the future of hair care is here. Buy Batiste Dry Shampoo online or in store at your nearest retailer.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. More than 9,000 Italians have tested positive for coronavirus. More than 460 have died, leading Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte last night to expand severe travel restrictions across the entire nation, putting 60 million Italians on lockdown.
Non ci sarà più una zona rossa.
There will not be any more Zone 1 or Zone 2 in the country. It will be Italy. Italy is a protected zone.
Un'Italia zona protetta.
While precautions were already being taken around the country, on Sunday at the Vatican, instead of being in St. Peter's Square in person, Pope Francis's face was projected onto large screens as he delivered the weekend prayer via live-streamed video.
È un po' strana questa preghiera dell'Angelus di oggi col Papa ingabbiato nella biblioteca.
It's a bit strange, this Angelus prayer today, with the Pope being caged in the library, Francis said. But I see you, and I am close to you. This mode of delivering the prayer is to adhere to preventative measures, Francis said. Well, in the northern Italian town of Codogno, out of the basement of a much humbler youth center, a tiny parish radio station has already been doing all it can to help the local community.
Ciao Max.
Ciao Fabio.
Ciao Francesco. Ciao a tutti voi all'ascolto.
Primo, saluto tutti. Primo giorno da Zona Arancione. No, che colore abbiamo oggi?
Radio Zona Rossa. Well, On Point producer Anna Bauman spoke with the people running the small station about the bigger purpose they're serving these days, and Anna's with me in the studio. Hi there, Anna.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so tell me who you spoke to with Radio Zona Rossa.
Right. So yesterday I spoke with Massimo Scaglioni. He's the president of Radio Zona Rossa, and his 19-year-old daughter, Chiara, translated for us. So before the coronavirus, the station was dedicated to religious broadcasts, mainly Catholic Mass. But once it became a serious situation in the town, they totally revamped their mission and rebranded as Radio Zona Rossa and have been broadcasting public health information twice a day.
Okay, so we should remark, though, that Codogno is actually pretty small, 15,000, 16,000 people,
yep.
Southeast of Milan in the Lombardy region of Italy, which has been really hit hard by coronavirus, been on lockdown for a couple of weeks. So first of all, what did Massimo and Chiara tell you about what that's been like?
Right, exactly. So the first patient with coronavirus tested positive in Codogno, so it's really the epicenter in Italy's northern region. Massimo and Chiara told me that people were really worried and completely unprepared to deal with this when it first came out about 2 weeks ago there. Barely anyone was on the streets. But yesterday when we spoke, which was a couple of hours before Conte announced the nationwide lockdown, Chiara told me that people have gotten used to the situation.
If you go out, you can see definitely way more people than, for instance, just what you could find around a week ago or even more 2 weeks ago when the whole situation started.
Well, and just to sort of provide a little more context for why Codogno is particularly important, as you said, Anna, the first Italian cases were in Codogno, right?
Right. So
okay.
The first patient was tested positive there. And after the cases increased in the area, the Italian government locked down 11 municipalities in that area. And, you know, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around what that actually looks like there. But, you know, as of last Monday, one of the region's top officials said that 10% of Lombardy's doctors and nurses were unable to work because they tested positive for the virus.
Okay, wow. So back to Massimo and Chiara then. When did they decide to turn this little parish radio station into Radio Zona Rosa?
Chiara told me that it was as soon as they were put under lockdown.
15 giorni fa, vista l'emergenza.
So basically, like 2 weeks ago, when the whole virus situation started, they thought about transforming and using the local radio they already owned in order to create a reference in order to help the citizens of these 10 towns, which had turned into the Zona Rossa, which is red zone, basically, the zone where there have been the most, the main cases of coronavirus here in Italy.
And so what do they talk about then?
So it's mainly elderly people in the town and surrounding area who are calling in, people who are most vulnerable to the virus. So the station shares times for free giveaways of face masks and diapers, and they have kept up the broadcasting of the mass, and they've even organized a story time for younger listeners who have been out of school. So during the first few days of the quarantine, Massimo and Chiara told me that people were so fearful they just needed someone to turn to.
Arrivavano chiamate in radio.
People usually called in during the radio program in order to ask the information about the time, the opening times of, for instance, post offices, of the bank, because lots of people, and mainly elder people, since they weren't able to leave their house and they were able either to see their relatives, they were out of money.
Oh, that's so interesting, Anna. So, I mean, in times like this, really basic information becomes incredibly important. And they're turning, the elderly population, they're turning to a local parish radio station. So,
Right. So
tell me more about what Massimo and Chiara told you about what purpose they think they're serving for the local community.
Right. They said more than anything, they want to connect people in the community and they really want to help regain a sense of normalcy for everyone who lives there. Now, one of our WBUR colleagues, Anna Benstead, we talked to her yesterday. She's in Italy right now in Tuscany. And what she says is it feels as though we are in some sort of futuristic setting, except it's current reality.
So wherever you can get that sense of normalcy, then very helpful in times like these. Well,
definitely.
You know, what's interesting is Italian culture especially is so very social,
mm-hmm.
right? Prime Minister Conte has called for restaurants and bars to close at 6 p.m. Obviously, there's no crowds at soccer games there. Schools are closed. So what impact is all of that having on Massimo and Chiara?
Well, one of the saddest things that Chiara told me was she had tickets to see Avril Lavigne, her favorite singer. And when she found out that Avril Lavigne canceled all of her tour dates in Italy, France, and Asia, here's what she said to me.
I was sad. Actually, I cried because I really wanted to see her because I've never been to one of her concerts and she is my favorite singer ever.
Right. So outside of talking about her father's radio station and completing her online coursework, Chiara has been answering the phones for Civil Protection. That's the national agency dedicated to managing emergencies like this one. Here's how she describes some of the phone calls she received.
Her son, which was a doctor in the Milan hospital, and he got sick, so he had to be interned into the hospital in like the intensive therapy. I felt really sorry for her. I felt like really sad, but I also felt good because I was listening to her, I was talking to her, and I was trying to help her. So I felt like, I don't know, a good feeling inside myself.
Mm. It seems like the importance of staying connected with your community and helping in whatever way you can is really being underscored in what Chiara told you. So what's next for Radio Zona Rosa and Chiara and Massimo?
Right. So Massimo says he plans to keep continuing these broadcasts through the end of the quarantine. And as far as we know now, schools and universities are closed at least until April 3rd. And Chiara hopes that she won't fall too far behind in her coursework. She's studying to be a fashion designer in Milan right now, and everything is now online.
Well, Anna Bauman, On Point producer, giving us a glimpse into the life of a couple of residents in Cordogno, Italy, who are in charge of Radio Zona Rossa there. Anna, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we are talking this hour about lockdown and quarantine rather broadly, but we have a perfect example of it now. First, it was in China. Now it's in Italy. So we're going to turn to some experts here in just a second. But what's your question about lockdowns and quarantines and self-isolation when it comes to trying to control the spread of a virulent disease? Or are you right now listening from inside your home where you are self-isolating? What has that been like? Well, let's turn now to Rebecca Katz. She joins us from Washington. She's director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She's researched quarantines for the past 10 years. Rebecca Katz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, can you just give us your first response to Prime Minister Conte spreading the sort of travel restrictions across all of Italy? Was that the right thing to do last night?
It's really hard to know exactly what the right actions are to be taking at this point. But they certainly, I think it's important to remember that 3 weeks ago, Italy only had 121 cases, and they're now over 9,000. So there was initial actions to limit population movement initially in the region, and then that was relaxed, and now the announcement that just came. So I think they are struggling, and we're also hearing reports from the ground from clinicians who say that their hospitals are really overwhelmed, and they're trying to take actions to spread out the spread of to bend the curve, to make the spread of disease slowed a little bit so that the healthcare community can actually address the needs of the population.
Right. I mean, we heard Anna report to us that in Lombardy, there's 10%. That's a huge fraction of doctors or healthcare workers in that region may not be able to look after patients right now because they're infected. Two. I mean, it is quite serious. Rebecca, I got an email from a very close friend of mine who lives in Venice, and he works for an environment office for the government of Venice. And he said in his email to me, he says, "This is the first time I've had to move around Italy with my passport that I need to show to police in order to say that I'm a public servant and free to move around Italy. The health system here may be entering a deep crisis." So Rebecca Katz, hang on for just a second. We want to learn a lot more from you about what quarantines do, how they're effective, how to make them actually achieve their goals when it comes to curbing the spread of disease. So stand by for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Listen closely. As a master painter carefully brushes Benjamin Moore Regal Select down the seam of the wall. It's like poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about quarantine and its effectiveness in spreading the stop of virulent diseases. Obviously, right now, everyone's thinking about coronavirus. We've seen quarantines be put in place in China. Now, in Italy, last night, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced that the entire country would essentially be on lockdown. I'm joined today by Rebecca Katz. She's director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University's Medical Center. She has researched quarantines for the past 10 years. Now, Rebecca, if we could just stick with the Italian moment here for just a second. Mm-hmm. I think just overnight, and things were constantly changing, but I was reading a lot of, like you said, confusion over sort of what exactly quarantine means across an entire European democracy here. I mean, is what they're doing the ideal type of quarantine? I think people are still free to move about their neighborhoods and towns.
Well, and my understanding is that they're also able to go to work. So it's not the same type of measures that we saw in China, but instead a lot more. I mean, I know that for the people in Italy, it doesn't feel like it's more relaxed, but it does allow them to actually leave their homes, to go to work, to take precautions, but not a full lockdown in the way that we saw in Wuhan.
Right. So they're not in their homes or just stuck in their buildings. And Conte also said that while Italians, I believe, will not be able to travel abroad, that people could still come to Italy. I found that a little confusing.
Well, and I think governments are struggling with trying to figure out what the best course of action is. We live in a globalized society, and people want to be able to move around, but taking actions such as fully banning people from coming into your country is pretty stringent. So I think the governments are really trying to figure out what is the real threat? How do we address that threat? Some governments are quarantining absolutely everybody, whether they're citizens or not, who are entering their country. So I think we're seeing a lot of different actions around the world as we grow the evidence base, as we start to figure out where the spread is, as we start to identify where there is community-based spread as opposed to single cases here or there, and try to figure out what are the best ways to kind of merge a containment and mitigation strategy.
Okay, so let me just ask you about that, Rebecca, if I may. Merging a containment and mitigation strategy, but right now we're not at the containment phase yet with coronavirus at all, are we?
Well, I personally think we have moved more into mitigation, but I think it's also dependent on where you are and what the case one, how you can identify what your situation is, and that has a lot to do with testing and the public health and healthcare infrastructure. But two, we are not seeing uniform spread around the world. So even in the United States, we're clearly seeing certain communities where there is widespread cases, and we do think that it is spreading within the community. And we see other communities where it may not yet be spreading throughout the community, and where in those situations, still taking more of a containment approach might be useful. And that's where you're doing a lot of focus on contact tracing and identifying and tracking down every single individual who may have been infected and how and taking actions to contain the spread. Mm. I think the challenge is that we are again, it's not uniform, but we are seeing much more community-based spread.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with our ability to actually detect that. And now that we're doing more testing in the United States, we should hopefully get a better understanding of where that's happening. But as I said, it's not uniform everywhere in the world. So clearly, Italy is having a lot of spread of the disease. We're seeing there's over 8,000 cases in Iran. In South Korea, there's over 7,500 cases, but they seem to actually be bending the curve a bit, and their numbers are going down. In China, I think there were only 19 cases in the last 24 hours, and two of that which were imported. So they really seem to be in a different place in their experience with the outbreak than in other countries.
Okay, so about China, we have a comment that's come in from onto our website. Kansas Patriot says, mass quarantines worked in China. Enough said. Bring on the quarantines and let's get it over with.
Well, they certainly, again, you know, we are in the middle of March right now. We're about 10 weeks into this outbreak. And there's a lot of evidence that we are collecting, and there's a lot of analysis that's going to be done simultaneously and also for years to come. But I think it's important to think about how we define success of a quarantine.
Right, right.
Quarantine, by definition, is curtailing individual rights. You are impacting population movement. And not all societies are okay with that. And I think that has a lot. I think what the Chinese were able to do, first of all, it's important to remember that it is completely unprecedented. We have never seen anything at that scale. That being said, when we think about quarantine and what is effective, we also have to, it's not just spread of the disease, but also the health and well-being of the population that is having their movement curtailed. Mm-hmm. And the mental health of the population is having their movement curtailed. And are we providing for food and water and communication and any other medical needs that they may have? And so thinking about, you know, I think we have to be really careful when we talk about these types of measures that we're not just focused on the spread of disease, but also on the population that's impacted.
Yeah. So, Rebecca, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you saying that, because you're exactly right. When we're talking about changing the day-to-day reality of life for tens, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, it's much more than just the disease itself. I mean, I'm thinking back to our WBUR colleague who's in Fiesole, Italy right now, just across the Arno from Florence, right? And she said it feels like they're living in some kind of crazy dystopian futuristic movie, except it's real life. So that's going to have an effect on people who aren't sick with coronavirus after some time. But let me just take a step back here for a second. I don't feel like we have seen, like you just said, we haven't seen large-scale quarantines like this in generations? I don't know, a century?
It feels like about 100 years.
100 years from Spanish flu time, from 1918?
Right. At this scale that we're talking about.
So why now?
Well, I think we are facing Bill Gates has said this is our 100-year threat. We are facing a respiratory virus that is easily transmissible, that has a case fatality rate that, even though we're still trying to better understand it, still seems to be about 10%, 10 times more deadly than influenza, than seasonal influenza. So this is a true public health threat, and it is a threat to which we don't currently have any medical countermeasures, which means that we have to be thinking about what's in the toolbox for non-pharmaceutical interventions. And social distancing is one of the tools in the toolbox. In fact, it's one of the few tools in the toolbox. And in fact, it's been a tool since biblical times. So we are in uncharted waters here. This is a and I think what people should remember is that our public health communities haven't had to make these types of decisions at this type of scale in, again, approximately 100 years. I mean, we've had other threats. There are other threats that thankfully haven't been as challenging as this, or have had other parameters that we were able to manage. But this is bringing us into a new world, and it means that there's not a massive evidence base that we can be drawing on for all of these decisions. So it means that decision makers are going to be operating with a bit of uncertainty and making the best judgments they can based off of the information that we have about the virus, about the evidence base, about our populations. But we're going to be studying this for a long time to come.
Yeah. So I wonder if do we know when, generally speaking, or I don't even know if there's a good context now within China or Italy about when these kinds of mass quarantines can be lifted. At what point in time, and do we know when the disease transmission rate has dropped to zero or just a couple?
Well, that's, I think, part of that evidence base. So China is certainly in most parts of the country is starting to lift restrictions. People are going back into, certainly into manufacturing, they are doing so with really very stringent monitoring. And the type of monitoring I'm not sure we are able to do in the United States. So even to get right now, so while they're reopening things, they're also very carefully tracking the movement of their entire population. So you get a QR code on your phone, which gives you, it's color coded. You're free to move around. You're not free to move around. They keep track of every, if you go onto a subway car, they know which car you were on. And this type of really aggressive monitoring will then enable them to do the type of contact tracing so that if additional cases pop up, they're able to rapidly identify who may have been exposed and to take containment measures. Now, again, that's not something I imagine we would be able or want to be able to pull off in the United States,
right?
Because we have different levels of civil liberties.
Such an important point here. Now, let me ask you, though, we've already got several thousand people, California, New York, mm-hmm. at least, under some kind of quarantine or isolation or self-quarantine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we might see the kind of large-scale quarantines that we've had in China and Italy? Could those come to the United States?
They might. And I think I don't imagine it would be a blanket statement, though. I think that a blanket decision. I think that this is a disease that is going to be impacting different communities in different ways, and not all at the same time. So I think that state and local public health authorities are, particularly in those that are currently more affected than others, are trying to make these decisions. And I think that when we think about social distancing, it's not just quarantine and isolation. It's a suite of activities that all contribute to what we call bending the curve, to slowing the spread of the disease. So I think this idea that it's all or nothing is not correct. Mm. So I think that we are seeing thousands of people in New York and California in particular who are currently under some type of quarantine. We are getting more information about the appropriate length of quarantine as we learn more about the virus and when symptoms develop and when people may be symptomatic. We're also seeing decisions that are being made or starting to be made about other types of social distancing. So whether that's school closures, whether that is moving to online courses in universities, whether that is teleworking, whether that's staggering work hours, so not everybody is on mass transit at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different I imagine we're going to start to see suites of social distancing measures and orders being put forward.
Yeah. Let's see if we can start turning to our callers here a little bit, Rebecca. So let's go to Dell, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Dell, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, does the 14-day quarantine period determine an individual is non-infectious or disease-free? And the second part is there like any data from past coronaviruses that suggests? So thank you.
Dell, thank you for your questions. Rebecca, do you have an answer for him about that 14-day period, first of all?
Right. Well, I think the best, this is a fluid situation and we're getting more information every single day. That 14-day quarantine, that period, was actually based on not just this coronavirus, but also our experience with past coronaviruses, including SARS and MERS. And there was a paper, some research that just came out, I believe in the last 24 hours, that identified that approximately 97% of people who develop symptoms do so within the first 11 and a half days. And that most symptoms, that many people are actually symptom-free for the first 5 days. Now, the question that we're still trying to figure out, and by we, I mean the entire scientific community around the world, is just how long somebody may be infectious. So it appears that that 14 days seems to be the right number for a quarantine for somebody to wait out if they actually develop symptoms.
Mm.
Now there's another question about isolation. So for people who do become sick, trying to identify how long they may be infectious to other people is information that's still evolving. It appears that at least the data coming out of China, that people can be with symptoms anywhere from 2 to almost 8 weeks.
Wow.
And then there's a question of how long, if there's a period of time after your symptoms abate, that you may still be infectious. And that's where again, a lot of public health officials and scientists around the world are desperately trying to figure that out, because it has implications for containment.
You know, Rebecca, we've got about a minute and a half before we have to take our second break here. But I imagine that these days your phone is ringing off the hook because people have so many questions about quarantine, its effectiveness, previous examples, all of the issues that you just raised on how to best manage these situations. But on the other hand, like, the whole concept of quarantine still seems like it belongs in yesteryear. I mean, have you had until today, I guess, have you had difficulty getting people to take this research seriously?
I think there is a small number of us who have been looking at issues of quarantine and isolation and trying to better understand not only the evidence base, but also kind of the best legal authorities and best practices for doing this. But it's been a relatively small collection of researchers around the world, because this just hasn't been something that's been, you know, on that we've that we've had to go to very often.
Have you been writing grants that get sent back to you with a no for all that time?
I got to be honest. I spent about 10 years trying to get our quarantine research funded.
Wow. Well, hopefully we're going to catch up with that now. Better late than never. So Rebecca Katz, director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. Hang on for just a moment. We've got a lot more to talk about when we come back. We are discussing this hour quarantine, of course, in light of the continued global spread of coronavirus. Yesterday, the Italian Prime Minister expanded the red zone in Italy to the entire nation, 60 million people. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Gold One knows that your skin changes all the time, like waking feeling hydrated, only to have dry skin after a walk on a cold day, or having dull skin at work, to glowing skin for date night. People don't have one skin, they have skins. And Gold One Lotion's clinically proven formulas contain 7 nourishing moisturizers, plus 3 vitamins to help you take care of all of them. For all your skins, Gold One. Visit goldbond.com to learn more.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about quarantines, about lockdowns when it comes to slowing the spread of virulent diseases. Obviously, we're discussing this now because that is what has happened in China for several weeks. Also now in Italy, as that entire nation, as of yesterday, was put on lockdown. That's 60 million Italians. I'm joined today by Rebecca Katz. She's director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She has researched quarantines for the past decade. She's with us from Washington. And joining us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Howard Markell. He's professor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and author of When Germs Travel, 6 Major Epidemics That Have Invaded America Since 1900 and the Fears That They Have Unleashed. Howard Markell, welcome to you.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
Okay, so if you were to compare coronavirus with one of the 6 major epidemics in your 2005 book, which one would it most closely compare to?
None of the above.
None of the above.
And by the way, the book before that was called Quarantine. So I've had quite a long history myself with the topic. You know, every infectious disease is different. These are different microbes that act differently. And even if they share some qualities, like they're both respiratory transmitted viruses. They still have differences in their route of travel, the incubation period, symptoms, and so on. So it's really mixing viral apples and oranges to, you know, I mean, the best example would be the influenza epidemic, particularly of 1918-19, because it is an easily transmitted a viral infection, respiratory infection. But, of course, that infection, that strain, was incredibly deadly. So about 40 million people around the world at least died during the year or so that it stalked the planet. And coronavirus, COVID-19, thankfully right now at least, doesn't appear to be quite that deadly. And we're hoping as we get more information about the mild cases, because, you know, case fatality rate is a fraction. It's the number of deaths over the total number of cases. And if we're only putting serious cases in the denominator, then our case fatality rate will be much higher. So it has already gone down from the 3% area to the 1%, and we're hopeful as we get more mild cases that that will get lower. That doesn't eliminate the fear or the concern or the tragedy of those who get sick and those who die of it, but it does make it a very different ball of wax than, say, something that was much more deadly.
Well, let me ask you, so the 1918 global flu pandemic has come up a couple of times here. What are the positive lessons to be learned from how the world handled that pandemic that we could or should be applying now, Howard?
Well, a very effective lesson in that we were asked at Michigan by the CDC to collaborate, more than 13 years ago, at looking at major American cities and how they responded to the threat of flu in 1918. You know, the menu of what are called non-pharmaceutical interventions was quite limited. You had quarantine and isolation. And by the way, the word quarantine now is being used so vastly differently by so many people that the originators in Venice in 1350 wouldn't know what we were talking about. You had quarantine and isolation. You had public gathering bans, whether they were theatrical events or bars or dances or vaudeville shows or sporting events, and school closures. And we took 43 cities because we had excellent data from the Census Department about week by week the number of cases of influenza and pneumonia and the number of deaths. And we could compare those in a statistical manner. And we found that cities had acted early because these containment measures or these mitigation strategies only work if you manage them or you drop them or you trigger them before the virus has a chance to spread and circulate throughout the community.
Okay, so can I just jump in here on that, because that's such an important point. And again, so let's bring it to the U.S. context today in 2020.
Right.
Like if these mitigation strategies work before the virus has had a chance to spread through the community, and we have a major issue with testing right now in the United States, are we already well behind the eight ball?
But we're always well behind the eight ball when we're on the heels of a microbe. And, you know, if they're concealed, we're actually giving it a head start. But history is littered with public health officials who either acted too early, and then everybody gets angry about that because these are incredibly disruptive to human society and economics and so on, or they acted too late, and then people get sick and or die. So hitting that sweet spot, you really have to be the Babe Ruth of public health to knock that one out of the park. It's very difficult. And, you know, some of us would argue it's better to act early than later if it's really a deadly virus. But we don't have all that information yet, so I can understand exactly. I mean, I have the easiest job in the world as a historian of quarantine because I evaluate this stuff 100 years after the fact.
Right. Well, so Rebecca Katz, did you want to respond to that?
Oh, I think what Dr. Markle is talking about is really spot on. And I think that's exactly the challenge that decision makers are facing right now is – you know, if you only know that you have a dozen or two dozen or even 100 cases of coronavirus in your city of COVID, what types of social distancing measures should we be putting into play right now? And to his point, there are a lot of – it is very disruptive, and there's a lot of economic consequences to particularly to kind of our most economically vulnerable people in society to put some of these major social distancing measures in place to think about canceling mass gatherings. And it feels a little bit like nobody wants to be first. I think we're slowly starting to see some of the more affected communities take some more aggressive actions. But it also feels like it's really hard to, as public health professionals trying to advise on some of these decisions, that it's that idea that, you know, we think it's best to act early. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other contributing factors that that are coming into play. And so I think there's a lot of decision makers kind of waiting just a little bit longer to figure out, to Dr. Merkel's yeah. point, like exactly how deadly is this and how do we know how many people there are? And I think this is a really important point. There's no exact trigger point. And a lot of people are looking for it, asking for it, but it's not terribly well defined about when you flip that switch.
Yeah. So about no one wanting to go first and then thinking about how also in the United States we have the variously sort of cooperative and yet fraught relationship between the federal government and state and local governments as well. So maybe, Howard, if we could, can you spend a minute or two telling us about moving forward in time, like H1N1 from, what was that, 2009?
Yes.
Does that provide sort of a more contemporary example of what works and doesn't work regarding isolating people who are ill?
It does, in that one of the things that I wanted to say about the 1918 study we did, that you had to act early. You had to do them for a long period of time as well, because if you didn't, the virus would come in. And it worked best if you layered more than one of these NPIs, if you did school closure, quarantine, and isolation together, or all three. In 2009, when it looked as if it was a very deadly virus, this was in the early weeks of the Mexican experience, the Ministry of Health in Mexico did precisely what we were finding and studying in 1918. They ordered all three, quarantine, isolation, school closure, and public gathering bans. And they relinquished them within 18 days because the case fatality rate, which was initially quite high, it was about 2.5 to 3%, dropped to about the level of seasonal flu because they found many more mild cases. And of course, as we were saying earlier, you would not disrupt society for something that was, you know, as deadly as seasonal flu. But if you look at the epidemic curve, that's what epidemiologists call it. It's like a graph that generally looks like a giant hump. Like a giant hump that is all the cases or deaths underneath of it. And with these strategies, you're trying to flatten that curve, stretch it out. And in fact, when you pulled those triggers, the cases fell down and the hump flattened. And then when you released them, the cases went back up again, but in Mexico's case, not nearly as drastically as the first hump, and of course, it wasn't very deadly. Yeah. So that actually reproduced epidemiologically the same things we were seeing in 1918, and that's the rationale today among so many different countries on a different way, different points, different strategies, different governments that is going on with containment strategies and, you know, social distancing today. It's all based on that work that we and a lot of other people were looking into over the last 15 years or more.
Interesting. Well, you know, in the process of preparing for this conversation today, Anna Bauman, our producer, she spoke to other people in Italy, including a woman named Julia Cooter, who's a podcaster. She lives in Brescia, Italy. It's about 100 kilometers from Milan. So they've been in the red zone for a while there. And Anna asked Julia if she had enough food, and Julia said yes. The first few days, it was crazy. Supermarkets were full of people. It was like we were in a war. We didn't know what was happening. But now she says people understand and they're trying to be normal. So I want to explore that more in just a second. But let's get one more call in here before we run out of too much time. Angela is calling from Lakeland, Florida. Angela, you're on the air.
Hello. My question is, with all the talk about quarantine and all of that, the only subject I haven't heard anyone discuss is what about the strategies or the plans or whatever for food, transportation, delivery, how available is, the disruption to food delivery.
Yeah. Angela, I'm so glad you asked that question because I actually think it's on a lot of people's minds. So thank you for that call. So Rebecca, Angela was asking about if they're self-quarantined.
Yep.
Hopefully maybe friends, neighbors, food delivery services. But I want to expand her question a little bit into, what if in the United States we start having regional quarantines? I'll give you an example. Like my local supermarket, there's a truck that pulls up to it every night that comes from like Tennessee to bring the food in. I mean, are those the kinds of things the system fragilities will have to be thinking about?
I think it's a really important question, but I don't think that's the type of situation we're going to be facing, at least not given what we know about the virus to date. I think if we were talking about an outbreak with something with a case fatality of like 40%, something like the types of thing you might see in an apocalyptic movie, that's when we might be really worried about food supply and water supply and things like that. But if we're really looking at something that truly is a case fatality of approximately 1%, that's the type of it's a very serious event. Mm. We're going to have to take action, but it's not the type of thing where I think we would be expecting any disruptions in food, water, or electricity.
Okay.
So I think, but that being said, every jurisdiction has different plans in place for how they're going to ensure that people who are having their population movement restricted have access to appropriate amounts of food and basic conditions for their well-being. And I know that even school districts that are discussing closing, mm-hmm, are making plans for ensuring that their students who receive food through school are able
That's
to continue
right.
to do so.
Yeah.
And we're seeing food delivery services put into, put policies in place where they will have a, no-touch delivery service, mm-hmm, where they drop the food off at your door and move on.
So Rebecca and Howard, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask you both to reflect with me about what a population's tolerance for quarantines is. Again, Italy being the closest example, it being a European democracy. I do wonder here in the United States if we have large-scale quarantines put into place in certain places. And there's many jurisdictions with militarized police. If there are checkpoints, for example, with tanks, etc. I mean, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, even if we're not close to that yet. I mean, Howard, what do you think the tolerance for that would be? Because we do run into civil liberties issues when we're talking about this.
Well, it's a great question. As a historian, I'm uncomfortable with predicting the future by definition, but I think the tolerance will not be great. But having said that, we are embarking on the greatest experiment of public health and quarantine and containment measures in the history of humankind. So I think we'll have answers to that in the coming weeks and months. My hope is that in the face of a threat, traditionally there are warfare threats, but generally, Americans react well. The better side of their angels kick in and they do the right thing. That doesn't mean we don't have to help people who are, for example, hourly workers or cannot necessarily not show up for work just because they're taking care of their kids because they won't get paid. We have to help those people if they're adding to the social contract by doing the right thing. The government has to do the right thing and help those people. And also we have to worry about the fact that, as you alluded to, that quarantine is not necessarily a federal order. It tends to be more of a local or state order, and that's based on constitutional issues that go way back to the early 19th century. But if there are internecine battles between different agencies at the municipal, state, and federal level, that too will cause problems. And if our leaders don't give a unified message, even though they may change it from day to day, because, you know, if we get new information, new data, that's good medicine. You change what's going on. But if they don't, if the Americans don't feel that the leaders are being truthful with them, that too will cause problems. So we're on a real tightrope here.
Well, Howard Markell is a professor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan, author of When Germs Travel and Quarantine as well. Dr. Markell, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Katz, director of the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. It was a great pleasure to have you on, Rebecca. Thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.